So you probably think you know the Mona Lisa, right? Like you've seen the parodies, the coffee mugs.
The inescapable crowds at the Louvre.
Oh, exactly. The inescapable crowds. But the painting hanging behind that bulletproof glass in Paris today is, well, it's not the painting Leonardo da Vinci actually finished.
No, not at all. I mean, the pigments have fundamentally degraded over the centuries. The surface is darkened, it's cracked, it's yellowed quite a bit.
Right. And what you're looking at is essentially a chemically altered mirage, which, by the way, happens to be hiding a secret 3D twin, this entire web of cosmic mathematics, and a true crime saga involving Pablo Picasso.
Yeah, and ironically, the painting's current status as this completely unavoidable global icon actually has very little to do with its Renaissance origins. It's almost entirely the result of a 20th century media frenzy.
Which is wild. So
Wow.
the mission of our deep dive today is to pull from this massive stack of sources, we're talking art history, cutting-edge scientific imaging, historical police records, to really strip away all that modern hype.
Because you really have to get past that to understand it.
Exactly. We want to bypass the sea of glowing smartphones at the museum and give you, the listener, a private microscopic view of this 13-millimeter thick piece of wood. A piece of wood that took over 10,000 hours to paint and is now valued at what, up to 2 billion euros?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
But to really grasp the reality of that object, you first have to confront its physical scale.
Right, because it's tiny.
It really is. When people finally fight their way to the front of the room at the Louvre, the universal reaction is usually just shock at how small it is. I mean, the panel is just 79.4 by 53.4 centimeters.
It's basically the size of a poster.
Yeah. But what Leonardo managed to engineer onto that tiny sheet of poplar wood completely altered human visual history.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because he engineered a face that seems to watch you, right? Like it actively reacts as you move around the room. And the mechanics of how he pulled off that illusion come down to a technique called sfumato.
Right, sfumato, which roughly translates to smoky or faded.
And he was essentially mimicking the biology of the human eye, wasn't he? Like hard coding this incredibly complex analog Instagram filter centuries before the camera was even invented.
That's a great way to put it, actually, because Leonardo understood that when we look at the real world, we don't actually see hard, dark outlines around objects.
Right, there's no sharp black line around my face right now.
Exactly. If you focus on someone's face, their edges in the periphery just blur. So he banned harsh lines from his canvas entirely. Instead, the background suddenly dissolves into this kind of atmospheric broom.
Like a visual fog.
Yes, a fog that recedes into the distance, exactly the way depth of field works in human vision.
And the process of just getting that image onto the wood in the first place is fascinating. The scientific scans in our sources highlight this method called the Spolvero technique.
The carbon dots.
Yeah. Right. Under the paint, they found these microscopic black carbon dots. So he originally drew the portrait on paper, meticulously poked these tiny holes along every single line of the sketch, laid that paper over the wood, and then just dusted it with charcoal powder.
Right, so those carbon dots formed the skeletal blueprint.
Oh, yeah.
But the way he added the flesh-like, the oil paint itself, reveals a level of dedication that honestly borders on obsession.
Oh, absolutely.
When researchers run X-rays on the Mona Lisa, they find a complete absence of brush strokes around her silhouette.
Wait, no brush strokes at all.
None. It's this nebulous, ghost-like transition. And the prevailing conclusion among art historians now is that to achieve that impossibly smooth, smoky gradient, Leonardo had to put his brushes down entirely.
So what did he use?
He painted with his bare fingers.
That is just incredible. And they've actually found his fingerprints preserved inside the layers of the glaze, right?
They have, yeah.
It adds such an intense tactile intimacy to the painting. I mean, he was physically massaging translucent layers of oil into the wood, waiting for them to dry, and repeating the process microscopically for years.
Decades, really. And that agonizingly slow method is what allowed him to pull off what some researchers describe as the first recorded instance of visual morphing.
Okay, the double face theory. Let's get into this because this blew my mind.
It's fascinating. If you isolate the left side of her face, the expression and the features depict an older, tired woman, and she's actually wearing a traditional morning veil.
Okay.
But as your eye tracks across the canvas to the right side of her face, the features shift. She transforms into a young, vibrant, smiling woman.
See, I have to push back on this a little bit. Are we sure we aren't just doing that thing where the human brain desperately looks for patterns, like, you know, seeing a face in a cloud?
Pareidolia.
Yeah. Right. Like, we might just be overanalyzing a lopsided smile and assuming a slip of the hand is this grand philosophical statement about two different timelines of a human life.
And, you know, that skepticism is completely valid until you look at the background architecture framing that face.
The horizon line.
Exactly. The horizon line of the landscape behind her is deliberately fractured. It is lower on the left and significantly higher on the right.
Oh, wow. I never noticed that.
And most people don't. On the left side, framing the older, melancholic face, the landscape is untamed, chaotic, totally devoid of human touch.
Okay, and in the middle?
In the center, you have this fleeting grace of her expression. And then on the right side, which frames the youthful face, the horizon jumps up, the colors shift, and the landscape changes character entirely.
So he's using the environment to map the passage of time.
Precisely. The uneven background is a deliberate mirror to the dual nature of her face, representing the journey from chaos to human life and back to chaos.
That structural imbalance perfectly explains why looking at her always feels slightly unsettling, like the ground is physically tilting.
Yeah, it creates a subtle psychological tension.
Which brings up the other unsettling detail, the missing eyebrows and eyelashes.
Ah, yes. The famous missing eyebrows.
So art historian Daniel Arras argues this was actually a deliberate 16th century fashion statement. Apparently, shaving off your eyebrows was a trend started by prostitutes that eventually trickled up into high society.
That's one theory, yeah. Though high-resolution spectral scans offer a much more mechanical explanation.
Which is what?
They suggest the eyebrows and eyelashes were originally painted on, but they were executed with such incredibly delicate microscopic glazes that they just vanished.
Like they just faded away.
They either naturally faded into transparency over the centuries, or, and this is a very real possibility, they were accidentally wiped away by a restorer during a clumsy cleaning attempt hundreds of years ago.
Oh, man. Imagine being the guy who accidentally wiped the eyebrows off the Mona Lisa.
A nightmare, honestly.
But regardless of whether they faded or were shaved, their absence gives her this sort of alien, ethereal quality. But a smoky, blurry face with missing eyebrows doesn't automatically make a painting the most famous image in human history.
No, it doesn't.
Our brains perceive that specific hazy face as structurally perfect.
Yeah.
And the sources point out that the reason we feel that perfection has nothing to do with paint and everything to do with math.
Absolutely. Because for Leonardo, painting was not merely an aesthetic craft. For him, it was a rigid, universal science.
Right. He was obsessed with the idea of divine creation.
Yes. He believed the universe was built on a hidden mathematical foundation and that an artist's ultimate duty was to discover that underlying code and replicate it.
And he had a massive advantage in cracking that code because of his inner circle. Like, he was close friends with a Franciscan friar named Luca Pacioli, right?
Yes, Pacioli. Yeah. He authored a foundational text called De Divina Proportione, or Divine Proportion.
And Leonardo actually drew the geometric illustrations for that exact book. So you can see Pacioli's absolute influence hard-coded into the Mona Lisa through the golden ratio.
Exactly. The golden ratio is a mathematical proportion, roughly 1.618, that appears repeatedly in nature and is universally pleasing to the human eye.
And the Mona Lisa is practically a masterclass in this specific geometry.
It really is. If you draw a bounding rectangle around her face, the dimensions perfectly lock in to a 13 by 21 centimeter grid.
And for anyone who knows their math, both 13 and 21 are numbers in the Fibonacci sequence. And if you divide 21 by 13, what do you get? 1.61, the golden ratio.
It dictates the entire spatial architecture of the canvas. You can trace the famous golden spiral starting precisely in the space between her nostrils.
Wow.
The spiral curves down perfectly along the edge of her chin, swoops up over the exact crown of her head, and spirals downward to end exactly at her navel.
That is wild.
The distance from the base of her neck to her pupil or from her chin to her lips, every single spatial relationship is rigorously calculated to match this number.
It's the source code of the universe. It's the exact same mathematical spiral you find in the arms of galaxies, in the arrangement of sunflower seeds, in the chambers of a nautilus shell. He was effectively hacking human perception.
He was. Our brains are biologically hardwired to recognize and find comfort in that specific mathematical ratio because we see it everywhere in the natural world.
He took the cosmic math that governs the shape of a hurricane and applied it to the proportions of a human cheekbone. But let me ask you this. Taking such a rigid algorithmic approach to art seems like a massive risk, doesn't it?
How so?
Well, you would think applying strict mathematical formulas to a portrait would strip away all the human emotion and leave you with something cold and robotic.
What's fascinating here is that it achieves the exact opposite.
Really?
Yeah, the mathematics strip away the trivial flaws and the highly specific asymmetrical quirks of a single individual. Leonardo wasn't trying to make a photorealistic copy of a merchant's wife.
Okay.
He was using her as a foundation to construct the symbol, a flawless divine harmony. He engineered the ideal universal woman.
Oh, I see.
When people from completely different cultures and eras stand in front of that painting and feel a strange resonance, they're reacting to the math. They're looking at the foundational harmony of nature, and nature is looking back at them.
That makes total sense. And if Leonardo had successfully formulated this reproducible mathematical science for capturing perfection, it stands to reason that the formula was being replicated. Which brings us to the Prado twin.
Ah, yes, the Prado twin.
So the Prado Museum in Madrid holds a copy of the Mona Lisa that spent centuries flying completely under the radar.
Yeah, for a very long time, it featured a solid, flat, black background. So art historians largely dismissed it as just an inferior, much later copy of the original.
Until 2010.
Right. In 2010, the Louvre requested to borrow it for an exhibition, which prompted the Prado to run some tests and clean it.
And removing that black overpaint, which was likely slapped on during the 18th century, revealed a Tuscan landscape that is absolutely identical to the background of the original Mona Lisa.
Identical. And when researchers scanned the Prado copy using infrared reflectography, they found the exact same underlying carbon dot sketch we talked about earlier.
But the true smoking gun was the presence of the identical repainters.
Yes, exactly.
The real-time corrections.
For those who might not know, when an artist is painting and decides to change their mind midway through, say, they shift the position of an index finger by a millimeter, or they widen the drape of a sleeve, that invisible correction is a repentir.
Right.
The Prado copy contained the exact same real-time corrections as Leonardo's original canvas.
Which completely obliterates the idea that someone painted it years later by just looking at the finished product.
Exactly. It means the Prado copy was painted side by side in the exact same room at the exact same time. Every time Leonardo updated his masterpiece, the artist sitting next to him updated the copy.
And because of the materials used, the copy actually operates as a better time machine than the original, doesn't it?
It really does. The original Mona Lisa was painted on a flimsy 13-millimeter poplar panel that has warped and darkened over time.
But the Prado copy was painted on a much thicker, higher quality piece of walnut wood measuring 18 millimeters.
And that walnut survived beautifully. Because it wasn't smothered in the same suffocating layers of historic varnish, it preserves the original color palette.
So looking at the Prado twin, you can actually see her red hair. You can see a bright, vibrant blue sky. You can even make out the intricate carved details of the wooden armrest on her chair.
Yeah, it's stunning. But it gets even crazier. As researchers Klaus Christian Carbon and Vera Hesslinger were comparing the digital images of the Louvre original and the Prado copy side by side, they noticed a bizarre structural anomaly.
The perspective shift.
Yes. The perspectives of the two paintings are slightly offset. There is a highly precise 5-centimeter perspective shift between the two images.
And 5 centimeters happens to be the exact average pupillary distance between a human being's left and right eye.
Exactly. When we look at the world, our left eye and our right eye capture 2 slightly different angles of the same scene. And our brain synthesizes those 2 angles to render depth.
Right. That's how 3D works.
So Leonardo and his studio partner were sitting just far enough apart to capture those 2 distinct angles. If you place the Prado twin and the Louvre original side by side and look through a stereoscope, your brain merges them.
That is unbelievable.
They form one of the earliest known 3D stereoscopic images in human history.
He essentially invented 3D imaging in the 16th century. Centuries before the technology even existed to properly view it.
Pretty much, yeah.
But wait, I have to push back here. If the Prado copy shares the exact same sketches, the exact same real-time corrections, was painted simultaneously in the same studio, and forms a deliberate mathematical 3D pair with the original.
I know where you're going with this.
Why is the art world so universally convinced that Leonardo didn't just paint both of them?
Because the physical brushwork on the surface completely betrays the artist. When you examine the Prado copy up close, the technique falls flat.
It's not as good.
Right. The strokes are too simple. They're too linear and too compact. It entirely lacks the magical sumato we discussed earlier. The atmospheric fog, that ghostly transition of light and shadow, it simply isn't there.
Okay, so who did paint it?
The leading consensus is that the twin was painted by one of his favorite pupils, perhaps Salai, Francesco Melzi, or Fernando Yáñez, who was a Spanish disciple known to be working in the studio at the time.
So they could perfectly copy the master's geometry and his structural forms, but they did not possess his superhuman genius for manipulating the oil paint itself.
Exactly. The structural math was reproducible, but the 10,000 hours of microscopic finger painting was not.
Okay, so we have an artifact that is a marvel of cosmic mathematics, a pioneer of 3D optical illusions, and a philosophical treatise on mortality. It would be completely logical to assume that this genius is the reason she is the most famous painting in the world.
It would be logical, but that assumption would be completely wrong.
Right. Because for the first 400 years of her existence, the Mona Lisa was deeply respected by art critics and academics, but she was absolutely not a global pop culture phenomenon.
No, she was just another nice painting. I mean, she spent time hanging in Napoleon's wife Josephine's bedroom. During the Franco-Prussian War in 1870, she was unceremoniously boxed up and hidden in the dusty subterranean arsenal of Brest in Brittany.
Yeah, prior to the 20th century, you could walk into the Louvre and she was just one masterpiece among thousands. Nobody was fighting for a selfie with her.
Everything changed on August 21st, 1911.
Enter Vincenzo Perugia.
Yes, an incredibly bold museum employee who recognized that the Louvre's security was virtually non-existent.
He literally just lifted the Mona Lisa off the wall, removed the painted wood panel from its frame, hid it under his smock, and walked out of the building.
He just walked right out. And the psychological fallout of that theft is what truly birthed the modern myth of the Mona Lisa.
It was the 1911 equivalent of going uncontrollably viral, right?
Exactly. The story dominated the front page of every major newspaper across the globe. The French magazine L'Illustration offered a staggering reward of 50,000 francs for her return.
And by 1912, the cultural obsession was so intense that the Nice Carnival featured a float dragging a donkey carrying the empty frame of the painting.
Which is just hilarious. Meanwhile, the actual police investigation was a complete masterclass in incompetence.
Oh, it was a disaster.
They attempted to use a brand new forensic technique called fingerprinting, but they completely botched it, because they didn't have Perugia's prints properly categorized on file.
And so, desperate for suspects, they began interrogating the Parisian avant-garde, eventually arresting the famous poet Guillaume Apollinaire.
And Apollinaire's arrest dragged Pablo Picasso straight into the interrogation room.
Wait, Picasso?
Yes. The Parisian police legitimately suspected that Picasso might be running an international art theft ring.
That is so crazy to think about.
But they actually had a decent reason to suspect him. Picasso and Apollinaire had previously purchased stolen Iberian statues from a known thief named Jerry Piret.
Okay, so it was an absolute circus of a criminal investigation. But Perugia managed to keep the painting hidden in a false bottom trunk in his Paris apartment for 2 full years before he finally got caught trying to fence it to an art dealer in Florence.
But the psychological damage, or I guess perhaps the psychological marketing of those 2 years, was permanent.
Permanent.
During the time she was missing, crowds of people literally lined up outside the Louvre, bought tickets, and walked into the gallery just to stare at the empty hooks on the wall where the painting used to be.
Staring at empty wall hooks, it perfectly encapsulates how human obsession is driven by absence. You know, we become infatuated with what is taken from us.
Absolutely.
And her survival story didn't even end with the heist. In 1956, a Bolivian cafe worker named Hugo Ungaza Villegas suffered a fit of madness, picked up a rock, and hurled it at the painting, shattering the protective glass and physically damaging the pigment near her left elbow.
Right. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, all of this trauma, the thefts, the wars, the subterranean arsenals, the rock-throwing vandals, it fundamentally changes the nature of the object we look at today.
Because you can no longer just walk up and casually observe the Mona Lisa. She is sealed inside a climate-controlled, heavily guarded, bulletproof glass box.
She is essentially treated like a geopolitical hostage.
Yeah.
The physical artwork has been entirely eclipsed by its own mythology. It morphed from a Renaissance portrait into this inaccessible religious relic.
And by the mid-20th century, the image had become so hopelessly overexposed that modern artists felt they had to actively vandalize her memory just to force the public to truly see her again.
Like Marcel Duchamp famously painting a mustache and goatee on a postcard reproduction of her.
Or Andy Warhol screen printing her in garish neon colors, treating her the exact same way he treated a can of Campbell's soup.
Right. They were reacting to the viral media icon, not to Leonardo's actual brushstrokes.
So, the next time you see a picture of the Mona Lisa, or if you brave the massive crowds at the Louvre yourself, the goal is to look past the bulletproof glass and the hype. Remember the microscopic carbon dots buried beneath the paint.
Remember the 10,000 hours Leonardo spent blending translucent oils with his bare fingers to mimic the depth of field of the human eye.
Remember the golden spirals of Pacioli's divine mathematics dictating the exact distance from her chin to her lips.
Remember her 3D Spanish twin painted simultaneously on a slab of walnut wood, waiting centuries to reveal a hidden stereoscopic secret?
And remember Vincenzo Perugia walking out of the Louvre with her tucked under his coat, accidentally transforming a masterful Renaissance experiment into the first viral global celebrity? Because being well-informed means stripping all of that modern noise away to see the science, the history, and the staggering genius underneath.
Well said. But there is one final piece of historical evidence to mull over before we end, a detail that fundamentally changes the context of everything we've just discussed.
Ooh, okay. Let's hear it.
So historical documents confirm that when Leonardo left Italy for France in his final years, he carried the Mona Lisa with him. A document discovered in 1999 reveals that he sold a batch of paintings to King Francis III in 1518 for the massive sum of 2,604 livres.
Wow. So he brought his portfolio to the king.
He did. But the crucial detail is who he didn't give the painting to.
What do you mean?
He never delivered the portrait to the man who actually commissioned it and paid for it. Francesco del Giocondo, the merchant husband of Lisa Gherardini. Leonardo kept the painting in his personal possession until the day he died.
Wait, why would he refuse to hand over a commissioned portrait to the client?
Well, what if the painting was never actually meant to be a portrait of a merchant's wife?
How?
What if Leonardo used Lisa Gherardini merely as a starting point, a blank canvas to construct his own deeply personal mathematical thesis on immortality?
So he just kept it for himself.
He carried that piece of poplar wood with him across the Alps, keeping it by his side through the final years of his life. Perhaps because he didn't see a portrait of a woman. Perhaps he kept it because he realized it was the one piece of art he ever created that served as a true, perfect mirror of the universe.
The real mirage isn't the hype or the media circus or the bulletproof glass. The real mirage is thinking we ever knew who she was in the first place. Catch you next time.